One local meteorologist called it the tri-state's four seasons in 4 days. Temperatures over the past week have gone from highs in the 70s to well below freezing. What can those dramatic shifts mean for the potential for tornadoes? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss how communities prepare for tornadoes and what we need to know to be ready are the Health Collaborative Vice President for Clinical Strategies, Tiffany Mattingly, Clinton County Emergency Management Agency Director, Tom Breckel, and Associate Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at The Ohio State University, Jana Hauser. Thank you all so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Jana, are we in tornado season now? I mean, we've just had a couple of tornado watches issued in greater Cincinnati in the past week or so.
Well, according to the climatology, the tornado season for our state specifically is roughly from April to July in terms of the maximum number of tornadoes that we receive. But that being said, we do receive tornadoes and have received tornadoes in every single month of the year. So while it's not quite peak season yet, we are definitely ramping up and getting ready to transition into those more springy type conditions.
Ah, what are those weather conditions, Jana, that can really result in tornadoes?
In our area, most of the time, these types of tornado conditions are going to be predecessed by having a large atmospheric low pressure system. So these are the big events that have cold fronts and warm fronts, the things that bring our everyday weather. But during the springtime months, we have this big transition from warm temperatures and we have relatively cold air that still remains, especially looking aloft above the ground. So you get this combination of warm and moist surface conditions that are being funneled up from the south in advance of these low pressure systems. And then you have really cold air above that, which creates a scenario that we refer to in meteorology as instability. So it's basically air that's hot at the surface and it can freely rise because it's less dense than the cold air above that. When you couple that with a lot of wind, the atmosphere will really start to get in a position where things start to get volatile. And if that wind increases in speed as you go up and changes direction as you go up, those combinations of everything coming together is what really facilitates the types of thunderstorms that ultimately produce tornadoes.
Jana, I think the last time Cincinnati's urban core had a tornado hit was in the 1970s. I can remember it being in my neighborhood and hearing all the commotion about that. Can they happen anywhere? Are there types of topography where tornadoes are more likely to hit?
This is a really great question. And the answer is yes, they can happen anywhere. The reason why it seems like downtown corridors tend to not get as many tornadoes as outlying areas is really simply because they have a smaller footprint. There's a lot more open land out there than there are city corridors. There is a little bit of truth to terrain impacting tornado potential, particularly enhancing tornado potential in certain areas rather than mitigating that. So I always like to tell people and caution people, you may hear these wives tales of like, oh, we're protected because there's a river here or there's a mountain here. But most of the time, those are very not scientifically accurate, and anybody should be preparing for a potential tornado event, even if historically you haven't experienced one.
Tiffany, I know the threat of tornadoes is a top concern for the Health Collaborative, and you held an emergency training exercise earlier this month. What's involved in an exercise like that, and what did you all learn from the one you just had?
Right. Yeah. So the Health Collaborative conducts what's called a hazard vulnerability assessment on a yearly basis. And we did determine that tornadoes was our number one hazard for which we were vulnerable. At the same time, the Health Collaborative is responsible for conducting what's called a medical response surge exercise on a yearly basis. So we married those together and we conducted an exercise to test our systems and our networks and how well they work together if we were to have a high-impact tornado hit our communities and therefore would have to send hundreds of patients to the hospital. So when we test a system like this, we have hundreds of people on the line across emergency management agencies and public health and our fire and EMS partners and our air care mobile care, and they're all testing our ability to coordinate and communicate with each other across multiple networks. And one of the main things that we're testing here is patient routing and making sure that we can route patients with the right to a hospital for the right level of care. So we're looking at patient acuity on the scene and using a system to best route those patients to the appropriate hospital. Hmm.
Tom, what did you feel like you learned from the exercise that you all just had?
Well, what I learned from the exercise is a lot of different organizations have different perspectives. And when you bring those perspectives together on a response, you really start to see that this response isn't organization specific. It is really a team sport. Everyone is participating at various levels and various degrees. And a lot of times there's different organizations that while they may not have that main role or task in transporting patients or something, they can still have a amplifying role in enabling someone else to be able to accomplish their missions.
Hmm. Well, we are talking about tornado preparedness and severe weather. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Tom, can you tell us more about how emergency management agencies like yours are involved in these kinds of exercises and why they're important to kind of practice this team sport, as you called it?
Well, a lot of these exercises can be held at different times of the year because when you think about it, when you're preparing for tornadoes, it is a year-round activity. As was said earlier, we've had tornadoes occur every month of the year here in the state of Ohio. And by working with fire departments, law enforcement, EMS, schools, public works, a lot of these different partners, that's where we go through. We check our plans, make sure that things haven't changed. You can change from one information system to another, and that may impact something else on down the line. So through these different tabletop exercises, as well as field exercises, you can not only demonstrate your capability, but validate, yes, your plans will work.
Mm. And that's what makes it so important. So yes, you're not just planning when and kind of keeping your fingers crossed if something happens that it's going to come together the way you think it will.
Exactly. And a lot of times it's important to stress those plans through exercises to see what breaks, where it breaks, and when it may break. By knowing those stress points, you can better mitigate those.
What are some of those stress points? Where can a plan break or is most can be most likely to break?
Well, you're looking in rural areas as an example, and this is one of the subjects that's really kind of near and dear to my heart. We have a lot of volunteer fire departments. So of our 9 fire districts in our county, 8 of them are considered volunteer, which means that they can be impacted just like anyone else. They can also have a job. They can have any other thing that may be competing against their time. So when you're looking at a response, whether it's trees down, lines down, or a trailer park has been hit and they have to do search and rescue, sometimes your plans may account for X firefighters being able to show up, but you may only have Y show up because of any number of reasons.
And that's where that collaboration is so important, because you can maybe call on neighboring fire departments to help out. Is that the idea?
Implement mutual aid. And then you also find out what non-governmental organizations may have similar type roles that you may be able to press into some other secondary roles to free up some other responders to step once again up to that first string role.
Makes sense. Tom, what goes into making sure communities are prepared for tornadoes? I'm wondering, can you learn lessons from previous tornadoes that have happened and what went right and what went wrong?
Oh, almost entirely through lessons learned, through what works and what doesn't work. But let's start at the household. That is the most important thing. And there's 3 key things that you've got to do. And I always state that you can do this within a conversation during your next dinner. What is your plan? Where do you go? How do you get the alert to take shelter? What do you take with you? That is very important. Whether or not you've got family members or you've got neighbors who's have maybe house that you go to because they have a location that's more suitable. What do you take with you in terms of what's in your emergency kit? How you're going to get the alert? What happens if the weather radio is down? What other backup means? And that's one of the first things people have problems on. They rely on just one form of alert, and that can be a single point of failure.
So if you're watching TV news and that's where you're getting all your information and your power goes out, you've got a problem, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah. Tiffany, how do local governments and hospitals and other organizations coordinate to make sure this team sport has everybody going the same direction?
Right. We do a lot of that. during our yearly planning. We're coming together as a coalition on a monthly basis. We're always in communication with each other. So we ensure that those relationships and those plans are in place before the tornado happens so that healthcare partners across the region are ready to communicate and problem solve. And this really allows the systems to support each other and that patients can continue receiving the care that they need. This coordination and communication happens in all sorts of different ways. We have radios where we talk to each other. We may have a virtual site or room set up that anybody can come in and out of and ask questions or ask for help. The hospitals will activate their internal incident command system. So they'll have all of their leaders and decision makers in a room together determining what they need to do. So you're relying on your partners to have their plans in place. And then the health collaborative basically serves more as like an air traffic controller. So we are triaging critical issues. We're responding to real-time requests for resources. We're responding to public information requests and communicating with stakeholders, as well as our local and state government. So there's that type of kind of organic interaction that's happening, but then there's also different systems and platforms that we're using. So for example, we use a patient routing tracking system. So when EMS determines that they're going to send a patient to a specific hospital and that patient has specific acuity, that is then entered into the system. So we know where those patients are going. That's incredibly important for what we call family reunification.
Right.
So when you think about if a tornado were to hit during the school day, right, how do we reunify families after the event? And so continuing to test those when we're not in the emergency and we're not in the middle of the disaster to make sure that we can best execute when we are is really what our coalition is set up to do.
Well, I imagine you've got to make sure every part of that coalition has backup communication systems.
Correct.
Too, right? Because like Tom was saying, for households, if you're relying on a landline and the phone lines go down, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that kind of redundancy important for all these
Yes.
organizations too?
Definitely. Testing our extended downtime capabilities is part of our exercises as well. So if we can't use our radios, if we can't use our computers, our cell phones, if the hospitals can't use their internal electronic communication systems, then what, right? So we're looking at that and testing that. And that's a recipe. There's sometimes some things are down and others aren't. So we put in what's called injects, basically, and what would happen if X happened, how are we going to respond?
Mm-hmm. Well, we will continue this conversation after a short break. And later in the program, new research about how a mother's antibodies can protect newborns from E. coli. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our conversation about how communities prepare for tornadoes and what we need to do to be ready. My guests are Associate Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at The Ohio State University, Jana Hauser, the Health Collaborative Vice President for Clinical Strategies, Tiffany Mattingly, and Clinton County Emergency Management Agency Director, Tom Breckel. You can join the conversation. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Jana, I think a lot of us, myself included, think of tornadoes as being just wildly unpredictable. How much better has atmospheric science gotten at predicting when and where tornadoes can happen?
Yeah, that's a loaded question. we have made huge strides in understanding the environments that are conducive for tornadoes, and especially when we have large-scale atmospheric conditions that are supportive of the storms that will ultimately produce tornadoes. But the kicker about tornadoes is that they are oftentimes very sensitive to local conditions, local scenarios. I mean, it can be even as much as, you know, a hill being present and changing the winds just enough that it tips the bucket from not having a tornado to having a tornado, for example, or you have some kind of localized agriculture, it's a bunch of cornfields that contribute additional moisture to the atmosphere that just provide a little extra nudge in terms of instability. So it's very difficult for our numerical prediction models to be able to capture details on such fine of a scale as is required for tornado forecast and prediction. The other tricky part is that tornadoes form incredibly rapidly, perhaps more rapidly than most people think. They will form on the order of 1 minute or less. Yes, believe it or not.
Wow.
So this isn't the storms that produce the tornadoes, but the tornadoes themselves. So it becomes a very difficult problem to be looking at a storm that is rotating and say, when is this storm actually going to make a tornado? And that degree of predictability is almost impossible for us to achieve because of the rapidity and the inability of our current observational systems to detect the predecessory events that are leading up to tornado formation.
Wow, a minute or less. Okay, Jen, I'm going to ask you another loaded question.
Fabulous.
Is this an area where AI could be helpful, like the robots out there? Could they be helpful in such a short amount of time?
Yeah, I think what AI can ultimately help us do to improve tornado predictability is to look at the vast amount of radar data that we have on tornadoes and to try to extrapolate signals that we as humans might miss that are present in the radar data leading up to the tornado formation. I mean, we have tens of thousands of tornado events now that we have archives for. So the place for AI might then be in deciphering all of these different tornado events and comparing them to non-tornado events to see if we can differentiate anything in the structure between the tornado-producing storms and those that don't produce tornadoes.
Jenna, what kind of impact is climate change having on tornadoes and the severe weather that can result in tornadoes?
That's the question of the decade, to be honest with you. So what we know, again, kind of talking, relating back to what we said earlier, is that the large-scale environments, we can identify how there are changes in the large-scale conditions and when those large-scale conditions become favorable for producing tornadoes. What we are seeing is a tendency for the total number of days that produce tornadoes to actually go down. So the number of days in a given calendar year is getting less. But what we're seeing happen is sort of on a flip side, the environment and the geographical footprint over which those conditions are favorable for tornadoes appears to be getting larger. So the net sum across the country is actually kind of zero. So despite what we sort of feel in our gut, like tornadoes are getting more frequent, when you look nationally across time and space, that's not the case. But we're seeing some differences in the allocation of where those tornadoes are occurring, when those tornadoes are occurring in the calendar year. And again, we're having larger outbreaks that are more newsworthy, but that's coming at the expense of fewer tornadoes where you have just like one or two little events that might have otherwise gone unnoticed.
So it sounds like, Jenna, climate change could maybe be causing a shift in what time of year we're seeing tornadoes or the regions in the country that are having tornadoes, but not necessarily the number of days, I mean, that we're experiencing them.
That's correct, yes.
Okay, interesting. Well, Tom, walk us through the difference between a tornado watch and a tornado warning, because I think a lot of people get confused about that.
I hope you like tacos. So when you watch a cooking show and you see them laying out the ingredients in these nice containers and everything is prepared on the board where they're ready to start building the tacos, there isn't a taco built yet, but all the ingredients are there. That is a taco watch. Or in this case, you would have all the ingredients present. That would be the tornado watch. And then as was just described earlier, the process about how quickly a tornado can spin up, it doesn't take a whole lot of time for those ingredients to gel and come into that type of wind event.
Okay. And then it's a bad taco. It's a taco warning.
Well, remember, yeah. You know, not everyone's going to get hit by the taco. It's not like a hurricane that it's hundreds of miles wide. While it's scary, very scary, the impact on the ground can be rather constrained to a small corridor.
Well, I have never heard that explained in such a delicious sounding way. So thank you, Tom. So, you know, we were talking about the need for redundancies. Tiffany, do you have thoughts on what the best way is for everybody to monitor severe weather and really make sure they're aware of those tornado watches and warnings when they come along?
So, Tom mentioned earlier about paying attention to having your TV on or having your phone, but not relying on just one type of communication. And actually, I think I will turn it back over to Tom because he shared something on the break about PACE, which I thought was very interesting.
from day to day, any task that you do, you have the primary way of doing it. Let's say it's your car. You're getting to work. Well, what if your car breaks down? What's your alternate? You're going to borrow someone else's car. And if you can't borrow someone's car, the next step is, hey, do you do like an Uber? Last thing, hey, maybe I'm going to walk it. So that is your PACE plan. Primary, alternate, contingency, and then emergency. By having that plan in place for what you would do for any type of disaster, your household's going to be better to respond and more likely to recover quicker than others.
So it's more than a plan A and plan B. You've got to have four plans. You've got to have backup after backup after backup.
And it's just wrapped into an acronym.
Yeah. So Tom, what are your backups? I'm going to ask you just for your own household. What are your backup solutions?
Well, our primary is going to be in our basement. We have what I call my mother's room. So when she gets old and retired, we're going to keep her down in the basement because we've got a finished room down there. But, you know, it's nice and cooler down there. That's our primary while we're down there. Now, if we can't get to it for whatever reason, we do have an interior bathroom on the first floor. It has no exterior walls, no windows. That's that location. After that, we look at going to our neighbor's house. We got Pat and Virginia next door. They're the place to go to. Emergency is if we're away from the house for whatever reason, we go find a low-lying area, a ditch, we lay down. We definitely will never take shelter underneath an overpass.
Why is that?
That becomes a wind tunnel.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And cars. I know some people get stuck in cars or they're in their cars when they hear this happen. What do you do then?
The right thing would be to get out of your car and get into a ditch for better protection. Now, if you're looking around and you can see the tornado and you see the path that it's going, you can make that decision, what am I going to do? But if you see it and it's coming right down the highway toward you, remember, you're contained inside of a device that can be blown around that is full of glass. Essentially, it's kind of a blender in a very bad way. So the more that you can separate yourself from that hazard, the safer you're going to be.
Okay. Well, some communities have outdoor weather sirens. I don't know, Tiffany or Tom, what do people need to know about what those mean when those sirens go off and how they should respond to them?
Every community is a little bit different. Most of them, we'll call them tornado sirens because that's what they use them for. Other places will call them outdoor warning sirens. They're used for severe weather. So it could be a severe thunderstorm or tornado. But here's the key thing. Outdoor, they're meant for people that are outdoors. When you're inside of a house, it's difficult to hear. You get the wind blowing a different direction. You may be asleep. You got the TV on. You get a lot of distractions. So when people say, when I hear the test, I can hear the siren, it's not the same thing during an alarm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when something's really going on out there. Okay. Well, I want to ask, I'll start with you, Jana. What's your best advice for how we should all be prepared for tornadoes? And do you have anything to add about how to stay safe if there's a tornado spotted near us?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I take away when I talk to members of my own community is there's sometimes a fatalistic mentality that is like, well, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. I'm not going to necessarily take preventative actions. And I feel like that's a little bit scary to me because there are ways that we can protect ourselves. Fundamentally, one of the most challenging things with our area in Ohio is that we have a lot of mobile homes that are around. And mobile homes will go and be blown over in wind speeds that aren't even tornado strength. So you can get a good 50 mile per hour winds at the right direction, and it can completely take a mobile home off of its moorings. So I always like to communicate with people, especially those individuals who are living in mobile homes, that you have the option right now to make that safety plan to identify your friends, your family, your neighbors, somebody close by who has sturdy shelter. The reality is the tornadoes that we get in Ohio most of the time are not going to completely level well-built structures. Now, there's always exceptions to the rule, but you will be much safer in a home that has a foundation and that has solid walls than you will be in a mobile home facility.
And that's true even if that home doesn't have a basement?
That is true. Yes, because the best place, if that home doesn't have a basement, is going to be an interior room that puts as many walls between your location and the exterior part of the house as possible. Mm-hmm. So an interior bathroom, an interior closet, some place that's smaller, because the smaller the structure is, the more structurally sound it will be. Bathrooms tend to be good because they have plumbing that anchor that room to the subsurface below. So that tends to be the advice. And, you know, you can have, again, a 50-mile-per-hour wind blow over a mobile home, but you have 50-mile-per-hour winds on a more solid structure, even if it doesn't have a basement, and you'll be okay.
Okay. Tiffany, anything you'd like to add to that?
No. Okay. That was very interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Tom, any final words?
And if you shelter, there's nothing that says you can't take a helmet with you and wear it. You can't, you know, take your pillows with you. You know, might as well be comfortable when you're sheltering. And it provides a little extra layer of protection if you have to put it above you.
That makes sense. Well,
can I jump in with that real quick?
Please do,
The bike helmet thing has been proven to save lives. So this is a really good campaign to get the word out there. If you have a tornado warning in your location, in your area, get those helmets and just put them on your heads, because the biggest killer of individuals in tornado events is blunt force trauma to the head by flying debris.
Important thing to keep in mind. I had never thought about a bike helmet, but I sure will now. I've been talking with Clinton County Emergency Management Agency Director Tom Breckel, Associate Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at The Ohio State University, Jana Hauser, and Health Collaborative Vice President for Clinical Strategies, Tiffany Mattingly. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, a new study looks at how a mother's antibodies can protect newborns from E. coli. This is Cincinnati Edition.